Hey, Bill Nye, the science guy here.
This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams.
I'm Mr. Deity, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour. I command you to listen now, or I will smite you.
Yes, I am a sound scientist. Came to evaluate the evidence on a closed case, highly classified, confidential, in a race against the clock.
Hi, this is Todd.
And this is Kim.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour podcast, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association.
Humanism. Humanism is valuing everything that we naturally are in this world above everything else and celebrating it daily.
Awesome. Indeed it is. Thank you for joining us, Kim. Listeners, Kim is our new co-host. And if I had a little button to do applause, which I don't have because I'm not a shock jock. You hear that. Welcome, Kim is our new co-host. Yay, bravo, yay. So she'll be joining us in the long term. We've been having a variety of awesome guest co-hosts who we will likely bring back from time to time if Kim or I can't make it. But Kim is going to be joining us from here on out, which will be great. And just to remind you folks who Kim is a activist, a mom, an awesome person, a friend of mine as well. She is a board member for the Triangle Freethought Society and a board member for Camp Quest South Carolina.
And I now can say I'm a counselor as well because I just did my first week as a counselor at Camp Quest South Carolina.
Oh, awesome. How was it?
It was amazing. It was literally, for real, one of the best weeks of my life. It was an incredible experience. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
It was.
I want to ask you more about it, but this month we have like a really cool interview and it's a lot longer than our normal one. So we're going to kind of cut the program a little short. This month we have Dan Savage being interviewed by Marty Klein. Now, Marty Klein, listeners, has been on the show before and is actually going to be our guest next month. So just as a quick reminder, and you'll learn a lot more about him in a few more weeks, he is a sex therapist, author, educator, and public policy analyst. He has books such as America's War on Sex, and he is certainly a fun guy, and we will be talking lots of sex next month with him.
Woohoo! And Dan Savage, I think most people know who Dan is. He writes the internationally syndicated relationship and sex advice column, Savage Love. And he and his husband, Terry Miller, began the It Gets Better project, which is absolutely amazing in my eyes. So it's going to be absolutely wonderful to see what he has to say after winning the Humanist of the Year.
I should warn all of you listeners that this particular episode is filled with very adult content. We have edited it down to be acceptable for radio since the show is a podcast but is also aired on real radio stations around the country. So we have to follow the FCC rules and therefore it's edited. But if you go to the show notes, which you can find at thehumanisthour.org, we will have a link to the unedited show if you want to hear the really nasty parts.
I'll be going there, yeah.
So with that, here is Dan and Marty.
This is Dr. Marty Klein. I have the pleasure of chatting with Dan Savage, author, political activist, and all-around intriguing guy. Dan, I'm so pleased to be talking with you. Congratulations on getting your award last night, Humanist of the Year.
I know, my God. Me and Jonas Salk.
You and Jonas Salk.
And Margaret Atwood and Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah.
Like I said last night at the banquet, I just think you're running out of people to give this award to. My name was drawn from a hat.
Well, it was either you or, we don't need to joke anymore about that. And by the way, you gave a great acceptance talk.
It was short
and really embodied the qualities of compassion and humanity that I think of when I think of you.
And thank you.
I was lucky. You know, I got to introduce you, and in order to do that, I had to do some research. And what I got was behind the lying piece of shit thing, you know, that you're so well known for. You know, especially, well, I guess we might as well start with the monogamy thing. I've been a marriage counselor for 33 years. So that's about 35,000, 36,000 sessions.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah. And as a sex therapist, I've seen a lot of cases where the sex just is not working with couples.
I just got a letter right before I came over. I looked at my email because I don't download my Savage Love email at least once or twice a day. My computer explodes when I turn it on. And it's from this woman who is in this relationship. She's in her 20s. She's married. And she just doesn't feel like she can be monogamous. And her sex life with her husband had fallen apart. She started cheating on him. And then she started f***ing her husband again. And the sex has been really great with her husband. But only now that she's feeling like her husband doesn't represent symbolically the death of all possibility, sexual adventure, variety. And she wants my help in how to break this to her husband that after he said, I would never want to be in a non-monogamous relationship, he's in one. He just doesn't know it. And I get so much mail from people where the solution is not monogamy. Mm-hmm. The solution to what is ailing these marriages, where one person isn't interested, the other person is, where one person is has a really high libido, the other has a really low libido. There's all this misery, and the keystone in so much of this misery is that we can't, in heterosexual marriage, I want to say, people can't conceive of or wrap their heads around maybe marriage is not about monogamy. Maybe monogamy weakens marriage. It doesn't strengthen marriage.
Yeah, and that's that challenge to the narrative of monogamy that I think you're doing so powerfully. It does raise an interesting question about integrity. Okay, so let's stipulate that for a lot of marriages, non-monogamy of some kind or other is going to be the best choice. How does a person look their beloved in the eye and lie to them and feel I'm okay?
Well, I don't think that people should lie. You know, I don't think people should make commitments they can't keep. And I don't think the culture should extract commitments from people under duress that we know they won't be able to keep.
But it does.
I've said a million times in my column, if you know, sometimes you're in a position where you have to do what you need to do to stay sane and stay married.
Right.
Usually for me, that involves a situation where someone's dependent on somebody else, that divorce might harm a lot of innocent bystanders in the form of children. Mm-hmm. And then maybe you get a pass. Also with kink, you know, I think non-kinky people don't understand that somebody with a foot fetish, somebody with an interest in, you know, female domination or whatever, that's not something that that person can will away. And that interest, that desire being eternally frustrated in a long-term relationship, that will cause that person to subconsciously or consciously sabotage the relationship to get that need met. And people go, oh my God, it's just a foot fetish thing. Okay, well, so let him do that with somebody else then. Let him go to a foot model party and get his foot fetish freak on. And as we've seen with 50 Shades of Grey, and as the male came in after that phenomena, it's not just men who have these frustrated desires for adventure or variety. It's also women. But women come to them later in life. Men know what their kinks are when they're 15 and they're first certain they're already experts at Women seem to come into their kinks, based on my reading of my mail from my readers, women seem to come into the understanding of what their weirdnesses are at 30, around the time of sexual peak for a woman. When's a boy's sexual peak? 15. Oh, suddenly he knows what his kinks are at 30. She knows what she's going to.
Well, I have a different explanation, but I observe the same thing. I think that women's sexuality is more plastic and more fluid.
Mm-hmm.
Men's sexuality tends to be more unidimensional. Mostly straight men, but I think men in general. And so when guys are at 15, they're focused on one or two things, whereas women, their sexuality as they go through adolescence and young adulthood is kind of expanding, and they're still kind of learning who they are.
What about the socialization of women to not be sexual and not have sexual agency and not make demands, not be able to speak up for themselves sexually? That may be part of what
I think that's part of it
locks
too.
Down a woman's aberrant sexual desires until later in life.
But
it's just a fact that it happens. And so, you know, all these situations are ones where I look at and go, okay, maybe cheating is better, but I don't think people should have to lie. And it was my experience. I was in a 5-year relationship before I met Terry. My ex and I were really good together. I really loved him. We were really not sexually compatible. And I cheated and I lied and I hated it. I hated lying to him. I felt like a dog and a terrible person. And when I got out of that relationship, I said, I'm never going to lie again. It's too much stress. And so luckily I'm gay, and it's easier for gay people to find romantic partners who aren't hung up eternally on monogamy. And I just said, everyone I dated after that, I was like, I will not be monogamous. I cannot do it. Mm-hmm. If you make me agree to monogamy, I will cheat on you. And then I met Terry, and he made me agree to monogamy for 4 or 5 years. And then he relaxed about it. And can I correct the record here? Whenever this gets written about, whenever like Terry and I get written about our relationship, got written about in the New York Times Magazine, they always make it sound like, talked about on the radio, they always make it sound like I chipped away at Terry for 5 years until he finally succumbed.
He caved in.
Yeah, he caved in and gave me what I want, which was permission for me to f*** a million other people. And the fact is that I like did it and I could do it and I could do it for him. And it was Terry that opened our relationship up. It was Terry who arrived at this place where he was ready and wanted to. And he initiated the sort of honest, open relationship, monogamish. There's just a little bit around the edges that we're in. And it's mostly been about him and not about me. You know, if you towed up all the people outside of our relationship that we've had sex with, and it's a very small tote board, you do not need an abacus, barely need a whiteboard. It's mostly been by and for and initiated by Terry, not by awful, awful me. Just wanted to set the record straight.
Did you know Dave McWhorter and Drew Madison?
No, I didn't.
Do you know who they are?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. They wrote the book The Male Couple.
Oh, I'm familiar with that. I have that book. See how terrible of names I am?
That was Dave and Drew.
It's on my shelf.
That was Dave and Drew. They were a well-known San Diego couple. In the book, that which is ancient, I mean, the book is from the 70s, they documented at that time that the most successful, huge percentage of successful gay male couples were not strictly monogamous, but that there was a culture of, okay, if you're going to bring somebody in, the other partner wants to vet them. They have to be respectful to the other partner. There's no question about who's the primary partner, all of that. Isn't it ironic, the interviewer leads you, isn't it ironic that with all this talk about how gay people want to destroy marriage, it's gay men who actually are able to see multiple forms of what marriage can look like so that you can have marriage.
Yeah. And we've remade marriage for ourselves. And I don't think it's about making marriage safe for gay men. I think it's about making but this laboratory with gay men that's reconceived a kind of marriage and a model for marriage that respects and accommodates male sexuality, not gay male sexuality, but male sexuality. And when you have two guys in a relationship and, you know, one of them hasn't been sort of instructed by the culture that she's there to police his desires, that she's there to be the regulator, that which is a real problem in a lot of opposite sex relationships based on my reading of my mail. And you have two people who are going to work this out and come to terms and come to an accommodation that allows the relationship to thrive and flourish. Absent that resentment and that irrationality about being in love means you don't want to fuck other people. Being in love means you commit to each other, you love each other. If you have a monogamous commitment, it means you have agreed to refrain from fucking other people. You will still want to fuck other people. The amount of time and energy, particularly in straight relationships, that people expend, if that's the right word, monitoring, policing each other for evidence of what both know to be true. Oh, you were looking at porn, you checked that person's out. Your personal trainer, you have the hots for your personal trainer. All this arguing and looking for evidence of what we know, what you should know, is happening. Even if your partner isn't f***ing other people, your partner wants to f*** other people. There's a great article on monogamy in The Guardian. I can't remember the researcher who was quoted because I'm terrible with names, who's described every monogamous relationship as a disaster waiting to happen because eventually along is going to come this incident. And, you know, hopefully it'll come in a form that's not fatal to the relationship. But if your investment is totally, if what you believe is most meaningful and the most meaningful sort of talismanic token of your lovers or your partners or your husband or your wife's proof of their love for you is that they never will f*** anyone else ever again, you will be shattered at some point over the course of a multi-decade relationship because the odds of it happening are so high. So we're setting every relationship up for failure in a way by encouraging people to not encourage people to be monogamous. And I always acknowledge there are upsides to monogamy around paternity, around disease, around emotional security to a certain extent, because it's true that if people are getting involved with other people sexually, they may fall for someone else sexually, and that could terminate the relationship they were in when they were out there being non-monogamous. There are upsides to monogamy, but there are downsides to it too. And one of the downsides is if you're really invested in it, the odds that then that predictable infidelity will end what is an otherwise wonderful and loving relationship skyrockets. Right. You want to, even if you want a monogamous commitment, a monogamous relationship, you need to short circuit the power of the infidelity that is likely to destroy it. Not by saying it's okay, you get a pass, I don't care, I forgive you in advance, but by saying we love each other, we're committed to each other, we're going to be monogamous. If this thing that often happens to people who've made monogamous commitments happens to us, we're going to agree now that we'll get through it and that we will work through it. And that we will not let it destroy everything else that's great about our relationship.
That's not a conversation most 24-year-olds are prepared to have.
I had that when Terry and I were adopting.
Well, how old were you?
He was 24, 25, and I was 31.
that's an unusual conversation for anyone to have, much less a 24-year-old.
It sometimes freaks out the marriage and monogamy marauders, because I wouldn't adopt with him if he didn't agree that an infidelity wasn't a relationship extinction level event. Because
that's
I wouldn't do that to a kid.
That's brilliant.
And it was about the kid. You know, I said he wanted to adopt. He was Mr. Monogamy and really adamant about it. And I was doing it. And I was just like, okay, we're adopting now. But, you know, you had said to me previously prior to the adoption, if I cheated, mm-hmm. and I'm just saying, you know, or if you cheated, that we were done. Mm-hmm. That was Terry's thing. And I said, well, that's fine and well and good when it's just about the two of us. But now that we're having a kid, that has to end. Because it would be unfair to bring this child in with that sword of Damocles hanging over that child's head, that if there's an infidelity, we're going to break up.
Mm-hmm.
How unfair to that kid. If there's an infidelity for that kid, we're going to work through it. We're going to get through it.
That's a wonderful way to think about it, that the sword of Damocles of the infidelity is not just over your heads, it's over his head.
Over your kid's heads.
Yeah.
And sometimes it drives the lefty, sexy, lefty people crazy that I emphasize children so much that... You know, if somebody writes me a letter and says, you know, this happened, I'm thinking I should leave, my first response always is, do you have children? Because that's going to really color my advice. Because I think the needs of children need to be taken into account. And the damage that may be done to a child has to be factored in. And maybe you should suck it the fuck up for your kids.
This question comes up mostly since the 1950s, which is the tension between doing what's best for your kids versus self-actualization and all of that. And the therapy industry, you know, is partly culpable. The therapy industry in some ways talks out of both sides of their mouth. Mm-hmm. When, you know, on the one hand, we say self-actualization is very important and you should be true to yourself and all that. On the other hand, we want everybody to be good parents and all that. Turns out that co-parenting when you and your mate live in different cities is really difficult,
mm-hmm.
really difficult. And that doesn't even include if you're really angry with each other.
No doubt. I'm against self-actualization. I once got
That's because you have it already.
I once got into trouble because...
You live in a gated community.
I do not. One of the things I get in trouble for is I've said to people that once you have kids, you can't keep reinventing yourself for a while. Constancy is a virtue that is under-discussed, undervalued, and I think is a huge gift you give your children, that mm-hmm. for a little while you put... You're just like, I'm in a cocoon and now I'm a different butterfly on hold.
Right.
Not that you can't keep learning, growing, not you can't change incrementally, but there's no like, you know, I'm moving to India with dragging these 7-year-olds along with me and reinventing my, I just think you need to, you know, like Barack Obama's mother, I think you need to stay rooted a little bit for your children's systems of security and in the world, in you, in your relationship, in their home. And I think that is important.
Have you had many conversations with DJ about his famous father and all that?
No, it's just it's been the air that he breathes and, you know, he knows that
it's his normal.
It's his normal. And he doesn't like it. Just like I didn't like the fact that my dad was a Catholic deacon
mm-hmm.
At the church that I went to that was attached to my Catholic grade school. My dad was on the altar every weekend. He gave the homily every weekend. He preached sermons. And so for us, it was a nightmare for us kids because we were held to a higher standard and more scrutinized than the other kids in the Catholic school because our dad was a deacon. And we, you know, we didn't like that scrutiny and we were self-conscious about it. So DJ's a little self-conscious about the fact that his dad is a sex writer and he doesn't like it in a healthy and appropriate way, just like I didn't like that my dad was a deacon.
Do you think of yourself as famous or do you think of yourself as known?
If it's fame, it's a kind of piddling minor localized celebrity. I'm known here and there in pockets. I'm not universally known or nationally known.
You don't think you're nationally known?
I'm infamous in pockets here and there. You know, I get recognized in every airport I go in, so maybe I am nationally known to some
extent. Well, that's one way to measure.
But, you know, I'm not a celebrity. We don't have that kind of wealth and fame. And I bitch and bitch and bitch about living in Seattle, but in some ways living in Seattle over the last 20 years as I've done this has been good because Seattle is so unpretentious and isolating in a way. And for people like me and Sherman Alexie and, you know, people in Soundgarden and other rock bands whose names I don't know, it's a good place to be. People leave you alone. People don't care. People aren't impressed. People are doing their own thing. And I can, you know, go to restaurants and go to bars and walk down the street and be unmolested.
So let's shift in our seats a little bit and talk about your more overtly political stuff. And I say overtly because all your stuff is political, as is mine, and as is any political activist. Anytime you do or don't pick your nose in public, it's mm-hmm. a political action. Were you surprised at the extraordinary response you got to the Google Santorum thing? I guess I should say what the Google Santorum thing is.
Rick Santorum in 2003 gave an interview to the Associated Press, compared not gay people, but gay relationships, people in long-term committed gay relationships, to kid rapists and dog. He compared those relationships, my relationship, to somebody who randomly runs out and rapes a child or a dog. It was actually dying down, and the political press had declared the little scandal over. George Bush had gone on TV and said Rick Santorum's a good man, and it was done. And a reader wrote me and said, I don't want this interview ever to be forgotten. I want this hung around his neck forever. You should have a contest to redefine Rick Santorum's last name, and then if that's successful, it'll memorialize forever this interview with you.
So that's the guy we should be talking to.
In a way, and I give him credit in the book. I unpack the whole Santorum campaign in my new book, and I totally give him credit. I quote his letter. And then my readers sent in proposed new definitions. I let my readers vote, and they picked the frothy mix of lube and fecal matter that is sometimes the byproduct of anal sex.
I love the word sometimes in that.
It's the operative word for me. The guy who invented the term, who I also interviewed in my new book, says frothy is the word that for him was the really important one. He was that was the word that he thought would catapult his new definition to victory. And I thought it was sometimes, because if you're doing anal sex right, there is no Santorum, lowercase or uppercase. There's no Rick Santorum and there's no substance Santorum.
Right.
Because if you're doing it right, there's no fecal matter if you know what you're doing. And I put that in the column, and I'm not tech savvy. People always say I'm really tech savvy because of the Santorum campaign and the It Gets Better campaign, mm-hmm. that I must be this like genius and these companies want to bring me in to talk about how to use the internet. And I'm really an idiot. I just floated that out there, but my readers ran with it. And Google investigated as to whether it had been Google bombed, if we had manipulated something, or my readers had. No, it was totally legit. That's why they didn't knock it out of the rankings. It was totally legit. This was being linked to and talked about and used in the new way, that people were actually looking for this new definition when they were searching it and clicking through to it. There was no manipulation of Google's algorithms. And then it just sat there forever. And then when he ran for president in 2012, all these stories were written about the 2003 AP interview, which was exactly what the reader who thought of it wanted.
Hang it around his neck
that
forever.
Hang it around his neck forever. Because anybody who said, oh, he's got this Google problem, well, why does he have this Google problem? Well, because this interview he gave led to this sex writer doing this with his readers. And it was unpacked over and over and over again in every story about Rick Santorum. And he had to answer for it. He was being asked in 2012, when he was running for president, about that interview, about his comments about gay couples and whether gay people, same-sex couples, were the moral equivalent of dog rapists and kitty fuckers. Mm-hmm. And I think when he said that in 2003, more Americans would probably have agreed with that statement. And then in 2012, because there's been such an advance in people's understanding of same-sex couples and our relationships and our loves and our lives, that what for Rick Santorum to throw out in 2003 is Republican red meat anti-gay hatery and not that controversial in 2012 really hurt him. And it's going to hurt him in 2016 when he runs again. And he is running again.
Wouldn't it be bizarre if that was the thing that tipped people away from voting for him?
It increasingly is. I mean, he's the rump, bigot, parliament block of the Republican Party, anti-gay ravers, anti-abortion, anti-access to birth control, right. The nutty anti-sex for pleasure wing, which is what links all those things.
Right.
Sex can't be for fun, even though human beings have 1,000 sexual encounters for every one live birth, even though straight married people have a great deal of sex and very few children, there's this religious Catholic understanding of sex that it should only be for procreation and only open to procreation. And then that is why they attack access to abortion, access to birth control, same-sex relationships, us in particular, because we only have recreational sex. We prove what sex is for. Intimacy, connection, release, and every once in a while, when the straight people do it, children. But straight people have sex for the same reason that gay people do 99.99% of the time.
Actually, the way that I put it when I lecture is that if you think of all the sex that's going to go on around the world tonight, almost none of it is deliberately for the point of conceiving. Almost none of it.
Nor should it be. And there should be less of it for conceiving. And however much of it was for conceiving, there should be less. There's too many people on the planet.
Spoken by a man who spends a lot of time in airports.
Yes.
Where there are way too many people.
Way too many people.
So going back to my question about Santorum, Were you surprised at the effectiveness of the campaign?
I was. I was surprised that it had the legs that it did. I was surprised that it held on to that top spot on Google for so many years, only finally to be knocked down in 2012 off the top ranking. And Santorum declared victory, but it was still the third return, so that definition was still sitting there right there at the top of the page for anyone who Googled him.
It's still on the first page, more than one entry, too.
Yeah, because there's more than the Urban Dictionary definition. It just pops up all over the place. I was surprised by its success, yes, because I thought I was just creating a little term that would float around in the sexual subcultures and, you know, the kind of urban sex-having fun young people who read my column that it would be. And it would, but the genius of it was this was a thing that actually existed that did not have a name, and it needed one. And Santorum's name is really kind of rare, and it sounds quasi-medical. I remember my other second favorite proposed definition of one of my readers was, you know, when you go to the doctor and they say, do you have any pain or itching during urination when they're doing the STI test? Right. Instead of saying that long sentence about asking if you have any pain or pussy discharge or this during urination, they could just say any Santorum. That was the other one. Or farting while someone's rimming you, that would be Santorum. Those are the couple of the other definitions that I thought that I liked. But just that was genius because Rick Santorum is obsessed with anal sex. He's obsessed with recreational sex. He's obsessed with gay sex. And to tie him forever to this unfortunate byproduct, this thing that when it does happen, when fecal matter appears during anal sex, it ruins it. It's over. And that's what Santorum himself would like to do. He'd like to ruin it for everyone. He wants to ruin sex for pleasure, ruin anal sex, ruin gay people's sex lives and their emotional and marital lives. And so it's just so delicious and brilliant. And so delicious. That's not a word you want to associate with Santorum.
No, it is delicious.
It's just so perfect in every way. It's so complete.
It's artistic.
It is. The guy who came up with the definition, total genius. And it was a thrill. After all these years, it was a thrill that he finally agreed to talk to me. He was really worried.
He was worried?
He's from a red state.
He didn't want to be identified?
He didn't want to be identified.
No kidding.
Professionally, it could really hurt him if it got out who he really was. And so I went round and round with him. I said, you know, I'll interview you on the phone. I'll let you see what I'm going to use. I'll let you see the whole chapter so you can see everything in context. I'm going to give you a pseudonym and you can approve it. So if it's too close... I offered to like change identifying details, you know, change this, change that, put you here, put you there. And he's like, no, I don't want to lie so that if I ever do get caught, I don't want you misrepresenting. So it's actually very kind of bare bones because I could only share a little bit of information about him that he was comfortable with having shared.
So for all of our listeners or all of our readers, it could be somebody living on your street who invented this.
It could be another member of the U.S. Senate.
There you go. Oh, what a great idea.
That's a new rumor, folks.
That's a new rumor. Spread that around.
It could have been Bob Kerry's second attempt because he famously said after meeting Rick Santorum and Rick Santorum walked away and he said, Santorum, what is that, Latin for ass? So maybe it was former Senator Bob Kerry's second attempt at redefining Santorum. Who knows who it was?
That's great. I think we can have a contest on imagining who actually that was. The It Gets Better campaign, another thing that – now, I don't know if you thought of that as a small thing that just got bigger than you ever imagined, or did you hope that that would be bigger than
– I'm old and gay, and it took – you know, AIDS happened. It took Ronald Reagan 7 years to say AIDS. The idea that when we launched this thing that within 4 to 6 weeks, the President of the United States would be making an It Gets Better video, didn't see that coming. Honestly, we had hoped when we launched it – very grandly called it the It Gets Better Project and rolled it out in my column. And it wasn't celebrity-based and it wasn't about politicians. If you read the column that I wrote about it, I was asking everyday ordinary LGBT people to share their stories, to make these videos. Because, you know, when a queer kid kills himself, part of what he's saying is he can't picture a future with enough joy in it to compensate for the pain he's in right now. And the research bears that out. There are these kids, queer kids out there, isolated, who can't imagine how they get from where they are to where someone like me is. And I don't mean like semi-famous piddling minor.
No, happy adult.
Happy adult. And we wanted, you know, when we rolled it out, we grandly called it the It Gets Better Project, grandly called it the It Gets Better Project's channel on YouTube with that one video of me and Terry. I wanted 100 videos. That was my goal, 100 videos, because I thought if we get 100, we'll get some of everybody, and I'll have this wonderful resource at my disposal for people, kids who write me, LGBT kids write me all the time from all over the country, and I'll be able to direct them to these videos. And if there's 100 of them, we'll get, you know, African-American gay guys living in Chicago.
Short, tall, white, black.
Short, tall, white, black, trans, cis. We'll get everybody if we get 100. Mm-hmm. And we got 5,000 in a week, and they just kept coming. What It Gets Better says is that there's 50,000 now. There's way over 100,000 now, according to Google. and there are It Gets Better projects in Paraguay, Uruguay, the United Kingdom, Vietnam, Chile. It just keeps going. NASA released an It Gets Better video.
NASA?
Yes.
Wow.
NASA came out with astronauts and engineers and managers at the Space Center who are all openly gay, lesbian, bi, or trans. And it just keeps going. The goal, though, wasn't we're going to have the most videos ever on a YouTube channel and we're going to get the president to do it and Pixar to do it.
That would be a trivial goal.
Yeah, the goal was to save lives.
Right.
And we know we have done that. We have heard from LGBT kids that the videos made the difference for. The people who approach me that have carte blanche anywhere in the world are now 19, 20-year-olds, so when I go to colleges, who were 15, 16, 17 when the videos hit, who come up to me just with tears running down their face, telling me that the videos saved them. And you have to take my f***ing word for this. You can actually go to YouTube and look up videos, and you can see kids commenting on the videos, and you can see the creators of each individual video then responding to the kid who's commenting on their video.
Oh, nice.
And you can see kids getting help and referrals and support in real time. You know, we've heard from these kids. There have been other suicides. We never said that the project could stop bullying, and we never said that it could prevent all future LGBT youth suicide. You know, in the case of Jamie Rademeyer, here was a kid who made an It Gets Better video, killed himself. And to watch his It Gets Better video after his death was shattering, because, you know, to watch it knowing that the kid he was talking to was himself, and it didn't work, you know? It just makes me cry every time I think about it. The pain that he was in. But they don't write newspaper stories about the kids who haven't killed themselves.
It's a dog bites man story.
Yeah, well, there's no story. Something didn't happen.
Right.
And we've heard from those kids that this thing didn't happen to. We've heard from thousands of them. If we'd gotten 100 videos, if we'd gotten 50 videos, and we'd saved a single life, the project would have been a huge success. That it's been so massive, and that it had these other, it accomplished these other things. The deal the culture made with queer adults since Stonewall, basically, was you're ours to torture until you're 18. Mm-hmm. And once you're 18, you can move away, you can come out, you can do what you want.
Right.
And if we haven't f***ed you up too badly, maybe you can have a life. There's one thing you cannot do, though. You cannot talk to the kids that we are still torturing, the queer kids in the same schools, homes, churches, families where you were tortured. And if you reach out to those kids, if you try to talk to them, if you empathize, if you offer them any assistance at all, we will accuse you of recruiting, of being pedophiles, of trying to seduce children into the gay lifestyle.
And that's the argument with the Boy Scouts right now.
Right. And it was so deadly politically, particularly in the 70s and 80s, that we, gay adults, backed the f*** off. We're like, all right, you know, once you're 18 and if you can escape, there's a community here for you. But until then, whoa, you're on your f***ing own like I was. And what was so beautiful about those first couple weeks when the videos poured in is you just saw all these LGBT adults. You saw the old order, this old deal, just collapse. You saw these people reaching out, speaking to, no longer being intimidated or silenced by that charge of recruiting or attempting to seduce kids into the gay lifestyle. That was over. And the other thing that it did was it gave so many people, politicians, sports teams, corporations, it became this question, like, are we going to make an It Gets Better video? Whose side are we on? Are we on the side of queer kids who are being bullied? Are we on the side of LGBT folks? Or are we on the side of the bullies and the bigots and the assholes who are destroying children, who are killing children? And a lot of people stepped up that moment and took a side. The president's video came out before the DADT repeal, while his Justice Department was still defending DOMA, before he delivered on any promises to the gay community. And I was very dubious, because I was one of the critics of the president in the first year, saying, enough with the speeches. Where are the results? Where are the promises being kept that were made to us? And so I watched the video thinking, if this is just more fine words and no action, I'm going to be pissed. Because he can offer more than hope. He can offer that change shit. And there hadn't been much of that at that point. And I watched President's video and I was like, oh, this is huge. You have the President of the United States looking gay boys in the eye and lesbian girls and bi kids and trans kids and saying, and he said, there's nothing wrong with you. And by implication, he is saying there's something wrong with the people telling you there's something wrong with you. And for queer kids, all too often, those people are their own parents and they're preachers. And the president inserted himself into the middle of that conflict and sided with the queer kids. That was huge. It blew my mind.
I'm convinced. That must have been quite a moment, to use a current cliche, you know, a game changer. I mean, when the president comes out and says there's nothing wrong with gay kids, every other position has to defend itself.
And that was, those are the side benefits. The chief benefit, it saved lives. You know, I hear from emergency room nurses who on their iPad will write me the next day and say, I was sat all night in bed with a kid who tried to kill himself watching videos on my iPad. And he hadn't even heard of the project. Some 15-year-old kid in Texas. And this nurse had laid with him in bed all night watching videos. And to have created this resource for people. And not, we didn't create it, to have sparked the creation of this resource. You know, we got an Emmy. We got an Emmy for the It Gets Better project. But that Emmy is for everybody who made a video. You know, the project is what it is. It's had the reach and impact that it's had. It's created this goldmine resource that will always exist because so many tens of thousands of other people made videos and participated in the creation of videos.
And at this point, I'm assuming that hundreds of entrepreneurs have talked to you about creating It Gets Better coffee mugs and keychains and socks.
We were speaking last night briefly about, you know, your critics from the crazy left and mine. And one of the early criticisms was right when it exploded, we trademarked everything, copyrighted everything, international trademark on the It Gets Better project. And the thing was, people were like, oh, it's going to be like those Life is Beautiful t-shirts for sale in airports, right? And the reason we did it was not because we wanted to do coffee mugs and t-shirts, but because we didn't want there to be coffee mugs and t-shirts. Mm-hmm. We also didn't want the message perverted or misused, which happened in Sweden, of all places, where an anti-gay organization started an It Gets Better campaign.
How odd.
I know. This like fundy Christian hate anti-gay corporation around adoption and foster care started this It Gets Better campaign that was explicitly anti-gay. And it was only because we had trademarked and copyrighted everything internationally that we were able to get lawyers and flatten them, which we did. The reason you haven't seen anybody profiting from the It Gets Better name, which is so huge and internationally known, is because we did this, because we trademarked and copyrighted it.
Now, since this is a humanist forum, it's appropriate to say that last night someone approached me who knew I was interviewing you and said, when you talk to Dan tomorrow, ask him about the following phenomenon, that there's all these atheist kids who they come out, they lose their families, they lose their friends, their churches throw them out, they're miserable, they want to kill themselves. Please ask Dan his thoughts on either somebody creating a side project or including atheist kids in the It Gets Better project or whatever. And you've probably been approached like this for other cohorts of kids anyway.
For mental illness, for lots of different permutations. Anyone's free to start their own It Gets Better style project, and there have been others. I've been tweeting out in the whole, you know, like tweeting is an activism. But I've been mentioning over and over again, as we debate allowing openly gay kids to remain in the Scouts, the debate keeps being framed as openly gay people joining the Scouts. Now, these are about kids who are now 14 who started scouting when they were 5 and are realizing they're gay, not throwing those kids out of the Scouts. It's not about gay kids joining Scouts. It's about kids who are already Scouts who grow up, realize they're gay, not being persecuted and thrown out of the Scouts. And I always say and tweet, like, maybe I hope they come around on the atheist kids too soon and stop throwing them out. Yeah, I've heard stories about atheist kids who have that problem and are persecuted, and it's very similar to the coming out process, and the blowback can be very similar to what a lot of gay kids suffer. I would be very into supporting a project that was affiliated with or aligned with or modeled on the It Gets Better project for those kids, but I am unapologetic about the It Gets Better project remaining focused on LGBT kids, because there's a unique need among LGBT kids for the love and support and the role models that they lack in their lives. And maybe it's so similar that they should be really closely affiliated. Because when I think of, you know, one of the criticisms of the project out of the gate was, it's not just queer kids who are bullied. It's not just gay kids who are bullied.
Right.
Straight kids who are bullied because they're geeks or smart or whatever. And I was aware of that. I called, actually, when the project was exploding and I was on TV all the time talking about it, I would invariably be asked about when I was bullied, and I would talk about St. Jerome's, which is where I was bullied, St. Jerome's, my middle school. And I was talking about it so much on TV, I began to think, oh, I bet my brother Billy has seen me talking about this on TV, and we're really close. And I called him and I said, just to say, I don't want you to think that I have forgotten that you had it worse at Jerome's than I did. I was bullied. You were brutally bullied at Jerome's. And I don't want you to think that as I talk about my bullying experience, I'm erasing that or forgetting it. I remember how much worse it was for you. And my older brother Billy is straight. And he's smart, and that's why he was bullied. It was the 70s. He read science fiction before that was cool. He typed his homework before kids did that in middle school. He knew the answer to every question and he aced every test and kids were brutal to him for that. And he said something very smart when I said, you know, it was worse for you at Jerome's. He said, yeah, every day. And he said, yeah, it was worse for me at Jerome's, but every day we would go home and I had mom and dad and you didn't. And that's the difference for a lot of queer kids who are bullied. But I can see that that would be very similar for atheist kids who come out as atheists. They go home to bullying at the hands of their parents who may be very angry about them walking away from their faith.
And if the church is a source of social support, you know, where they're in a church youth group or their friends all hang out at church or whatever, and then they lose that, it's about more than ideology. It's about losing your social network and all of that.
Some of the advice I give gay kids is think about when and how you're going to come out and when's the right time. Because the last thing I want to see is a gay kid being told that they're letting down the side. If, you know, you're 15 or 16, you know you're gay and you're not out, you're not a good gay person. You know, you got to be out because the consequences for being out can be so extraordinary and deadly. Kids, 40% of homeless youth are gay kids who were thrown out after they came out or were outed.
Right.
I always tell gay kids to look at who your family is and wait. If they're gonna retaliate against you, you know, go on deep cover and wait. And maybe that's advice that some atheist kids should get. If it's your entire social network and your parents are psychotic, which is what I tell queer kids, if your parents are crazy and you live in a place full of people who are gonna be to you, you can wait. You're not a bad gay person for being a smart gay person and timing it. In such a way, timing your coming out in such a way that you're not going to nuke your own life in the process. Take notes and wait.
Have you gotten criticism from the gay community, from purists who say you're being, internalized homophobia or that you're...
I tell gay kids to wait?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There was a side project, you know, some people said it gets better, it's too passive. You're just telling kids to wait around and things will improve without them having to do anything. Or them taking control and agency and making it better for themselves. And there was a Make It Better project that someone started. And I thought, you know, once, okay, yeah, the message, you know, if you're phrase making, yeah, the message is a little passive, it gets better, not you did something to make it better. But if you watch the videos, almost all of them are about what these people did to improve their own lives, including this one by a gay kid who was 17 when he made his video about he was in this place, everyone was horrible, he got his GED and went straight to college. It's like, it's straight to community college. I'm not going to sit in this high school and get my face beaten in for no reason. So I can go to prom. It's like, I'm out. And so a lot of the It Gets Better videos laid out how to make it better, like the steps you could proactively take to improve your lot. But the Make It Better videos that I watched were, and I said this to them, they wanted me to like promote them and talk about them. And I did a little bit, just acknowledge it. I did a thing in my column saying there's this other thing, may have merit as well. But I watched the videos and they were bullying gay kids. They're saying, if you're not out, if you haven't helped perform a GSA at your school, then you're not doing all you can. You got to make it better. You got to get off your ass. And that sort of unrealistic horse that some gay people traffic in, without recognizing there are some kids who are trapped. They can make no move at all. And all we can give them right now is an image of the future and also, you know, some advice about how to get there without nuking their lives right now. It was just bullying. It was more bullying. It's like, oh, you're 15 years old and you're growing up in some small town and your parents are rapidly anti-gay and you have no resources, no help, and no friends, and you're not out, well, you're part of the problem. I'm not going to send that message to gay kids. You know, everybody, adults forget what it's like to be a vulnerable teenager, and gay adults forget a lot, sometimes it feels like. And we want to say, come out, it's the solution to all your problems. No, it's often the beginning of all new problems. And they can be life and death problems for a 16-year-old who gets thrown out of the house because she's a lesbian.
It can be the beginning of adult problems.
That's what I tell the kids. I also get in trouble for, I'm accused of being homophobic because I tell them not all gay people are good. When I talk at colleges and or to younger people, I'm always, one of the things I always throw out there is Jeffrey Dahmer ate a friend of mine. Not everybody you meet in a gay bar or at a gay pride parade is going to be a decent human being. You cannot do this thing that straight people suck and gay people are awesome. And once I'm away from the straight people, I'm around the gay people, I'm with my gay and lesbian brothers and sisters and I'm safe. No, you're vulnerable in new ways. And I'm not supposed to say that. People get mad at me when I say that to gay kids. I have brothers, my gay and lesbian brothers and sisters. I have actual brothers. I never got a rope burn or an STI or my heart broken by my actual brothers. You will get all that from your gay brothers. You know, a lot of gay kids come out, lesbian kids, they come out with their force field down. They come out, you know, they've had the like wall up to protect themselves and they've been very, the bull detectors up and force field on full, and they come out and like, oh, I can relax. Like, no, no, you really can't. There are sexual predators in the LGBT community. There are just in the LGBT community. There are not nice people in the LGBT community. You could be not nice a person. We can't say that we commit suicide at greater rates, attempt suicide at greater rates, drink at higher rates, abuse drugs, to be distinguished from used drugs, at higher rates. And some of us are very sexually destructive, self-destructive, at higher rates because of the homophobia, because of what's done to us when we're young, because of what the culture says about us. But we're also all wonderful people to be with and hang out with and the nicest people on earth. And once you're out, it's going to be like a birthday party that your mom threw you for the rest of your life. No, like gay people are also raving at a higher rate in the same way, self-destructive and other destructive at a higher rate. We are.
I see the pull quote right there, Dan.
Well, we are. I wrote years ago that to be gay is like to exclusively select from a pool of Vietnam vets your romantic partners. With that cliche, stereotype, unfair prejudice that Vietnam vets are crazier at higher rates than the general population, it doesn't mean they're all crazy, but every once in a while, remember the 70s, one would shoot up a McDonald's, right? And people are like, whoa, Vietnam vets. It's like, that's what we are. A lot of us are walking wounded. Mm-hmm. And the trick when you come out is to learn how to spot and avoid those walking wounded queer people and the walking wounded straights. But there are more walking wounded queers. There just are. To learn to avoid them and to self-assess and make sure you are not one yourself. And that's hard. And that's complicated. And you're not allowed to say that because it contradicts the, like, rainbow windsock waving part of the Pride Parade.
Well, I'd like you to please talk about that a little bit, which is the way that you've been attacked from the left and how the leftist movements or progressive movements. We had a great example of that last night during the Q&A for your banquet. How do you deal with being attacked from the left, and what sort of political advice do you want to give people who are just so angry?
At me?
Well, not just at you, but at reality, I guess. I mean, you know, there's this common expression, the problem of making the perfect is the enemy of the good, right? So last night, this person stands up and supposedly asks you a question. It was reads a statement about how dangerous and destructive you've been when you're undoubtedly the best friend that this person has ever had and will ever have. A, how do you deal with that personally? And B, what do you have to say to a movement who keeps eating its leaders like that?
Well, the narcissism of small differences, right? And, you know, when I get attacked for being transphobic and then I watch Keith Ablow go on Fox News and say that parents shouldn't allow their children to watch Dancing with the Stars with Chaz Bono because their sons will then turn around and cut their d*** off. And I think, okay, if I'm transphobic, what the hell is he? And why am I the one who's getting all the grief? I'm accused of being transphobic because until the trans movement sent out a memo saying that tranny was now a hate term and nobody could use it, and I basically stopped using it in the column. But up until that point, like, Kate Bornstein would use it and Buck Angel would use it, and it was just sort of in common usage. But they changed the rules, and now they select the radical crazy activists. They'll pull things out from pre the announcement that we couldn't use this word and say, look, he used tranny in his column. But I also use faggot in my column. I've defended straight white male comedians from GLAAD that used faggot. If I fell down on the floor and clutched my pearls and had a fit when somebody used faggot and then I turned around and used tranny, okay, well, then I'm a hypocrite. The ideas behind the column was I was going to let everybody use the words they actually use when they talk about sex.
Right.
Including hate terms in a non-hateful way, non-hateful context of my column and colloquialisms and sexual slang. So what do I do? What do I say? You know, sometimes it gets to me. It couldn't not. I don't like being glittered, as I have been.
Glittered?
Yeah, people throw glitter at you, especially when they throw the jar the glitter was in at your face. And the problem with it is that people go, you know, right now, gender is the issue. Where there's a lot of focus on trans issues, as there should be. You know, the movement moves on to things that we have not yet nailed down or fully unpacked. But what gets out there is, oh, trans people hate him. He must be transphobic. And so people who haven't read you just go, oh, you're that transphobic guy. Some crazy mother threw a jar at your face. You have to respond to a certain point. I have this big platform. And one of the ways that I retaliate is by continuing to share it. Kate Bornstein, I've known for almost 20 years. And she's a wonderful person. And she's battling cancer right now, and if she, you know, by any chance she hears this, hey, Kate, and I hope you're doing well. She's been in my column for 17 years. giving advice, speaking for trans women, speaking from the trans perspective, not speaking for all trans women, just as I don't speak for all gay men. And she's a hero, and rightly so, to a lot of people in trans land and a lot of the social justice trans nuts. She's a hero. And I continue to offer Kate my platform. And sometimes when I do it, I think, you know, I have to set aside, like, this is going to piss off the people who hate me because they love Kate and they hate me and they think I'm like the Antichrist. So I'm going to, like, quote Kate this week because that'll piss them off. But I don't want to use Kate, you know what I mean, to piss off them. Asexuals think I'm the enemy of asexuals, but I'm just the enemy of people who are asexual misrepresenting themselves to people who are sexual. As some asexuals justified to me in columns a while ago. But I just had David Jay back on the podcast, who founded AVN, the Asexual Visibility and Education, AVEN, Asexual Visibility and Education Network, because somebody got a question about asexuality, and I'm going to give my podcast and some time to David and let him talk and let him speak. And part of me goes, that's the right thing to do. I should do that. And part of me goes, well, this will piss off the people who think that I hate asexuals and I'm the enemy of asexuality everywhere.
You seem to portray yourself as a person who doesn't mind being misunderstood on a daily basis. Surely that can't be true.
I have to do. I don't want to go to NGLTF's Creating Change conference. I'm not sort of invested in a position of leadership in Gayland. I speak for myself. I write what I think. I do my column. I have my family. I go snowboarding with my son. I live in Seattle. I'm not part of this, like, hothouse little queer terrarium environment, and I have no desire to be a part of it. I don't want to be on anybody's board. Anytime anyone's ever asked me to be on a board, I've kind of laughed and go, you realize that I would never do this. I don't want to be on a board, but you do realize that.
I will make trouble.
It will be trouble if you have me on your board. Then it'll just be a nightmare for you for having invited me, so.
So you've just been given an award by the American Humanist Association, and as you say,
they just ran out of people.
They ran out of people. So it turns out we didn't just run out of people. We had a few other bankrupt airlines we could have flown on, but we chose yours.
Oh, well, thank you.
What does this mean to you, Dan? I mean, can you say some charming things?
Well, it's really, I mean, I admire the organization very much, and I am a humanist and I'm an atheist. So I joke about being a Catholic. I call myself a Catholic, culturally Catholic. It is, you know, to be publicly, you know, good without God. And I think I am good without God. And I think a lot of my writing is about how to get there and do that and how to have sort of an ethical approach to sexuality, which is important because you can destroy someone with your, you really can. You can shatter a person. And so you have to think and feel and empathize and do unto others as you have them do unto you. And so to have that sort of ethic that I've kind of been jokingly unpacking in my column for so long, to have that thread teased out and recognized and honored was kind
of... Yes, honored is the word.
Kind of shocking, but very gratifying. Because, you know, the thing I get from the right, as opposed to the queer left, the thing I get from the right is I'm an amoral hedonist, anything goes, if it feels good, do it. And I'm not that. Anybody who reads my column, I don't think more than once... or just doesn't read a column about, you know, play or something, is going to come away without the impression that I'm the anything goes guy. Because I really do think that there's an ethical, moral framework that you have to construct for your sexuality and how you express it and how you move through the world interacting with other people. And it feels like that was what was being recognized by the Humanist Association. And that's gratifying because I kind of bury it in my column.
Not well enough. Not well enough for me.
I bury the activism too. I was an activist for a long time. I was in ACT UP, I was an activist on college campus for queer rights. And I started writing this column and I was like, oh, this is activism. 90% of the time it's about straight people. 90% of the time it's jokes and dirt and smut and sex and advice. But every once in a while, because these people read me and they trust me and they know I'm not going to waste their time, if I say do this, they'll do it. Just like the It Gets Better Project, which I launched in my column. Like, here's a thing that needs doing. You like me, you trust me, you read me, do it. And I have this ability to do that. You know, when Constance McMillan's high school was f***ing with her, I was one of the first people to write about it and talk about it. And I said to my readers, get on this. And my listeners, let's do this. The school was saying they couldn't let her go to prom with her girlfriend because it would be too big a distraction.
Right.
And then they canceled prom, which was a move to get her killed. In a small town in Mississippi, nobody gets to go to prom because this bitch wanted to take her girlfriend to prom. Get her. They were painting a bullseye on her back. And at that moment, I said to my listeners and readers, let's make discriminating against gay kids a much bigger distraction than treating them fairly ever could be. And people just jumped on that school and jumped on that school board. And they flipped, they freaked. And then the ACLU was on top of them too. And they were just miserable. And it floats out there in schoolland as this example of, it's a little bit of protection. And there's still schools with queer kids. But the lesson and example of Constance McMillan and what happened to that school and school board and the money that they had to pay and the grief and the all that anger, all those emails, all those faxes, all those phone calls mattered. For me, that, in a way, as the sort of like ethical and savage love that a lot of people don't recognize, but the Humanist Association did, but the activism and savage love, I call them my flying monkeys. I call them out every once in a while. I don't abuse them. I don't do it every day. One of the things that some people on the left are mad at me about, queer left that I hear from, is that every week's column isn't a cri de coeur, however you say that.
Cri de coeur. Cri de coeur. You don't do it more often.
That I don't do it always, mm-hmm. week after week, because there's always some injustice. Like, you know, I have to keep this powder dry for when I really,
absolutely.
When something really needs to be exploded. One of the problems with the left is always making people feel guilty about not doing everything and enough. And I borrow from the right, and from my own activism back in the day with ACT UP, you want to identify the small ask and the doable thing, because that makes people feel empowered. And then they're likelier to do the next doable thing and the next doable thing. And then they find themselves doing a lot more than they realized they could. But if you just lay in front of them all the world's problems and go, you're a bad person if you can't fix all of this right now, that was what It Gets Better was. Here's a doable thing.
Right.
Sit in front of your computer and talk for 12 minutes, 10 minutes. Make a video. Talk. And upload it. It's a small, doable thing that can make a difference.
You know, when I lecture on America's War on Sex and people ask me, what can I do? I say, well, for starters, how about if you write a letter to the editor of your local newspaper? And people look at me like, how square is that? You know, how dumbass is that? I say, you know what? You'd be amazed at how few letters they get. And people are going to read your letter.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to do more than that, we can think of things you can do. Have you called your state legislator lately and say, I'd like to drop in and say hi? People say, that's just so square. I say, yes.
And it makes a difference.
And it matters. So you're absolutely right.
And you know who does that?
Yes.
Right-wing nutbags. They're up their state legislators' butts, and they're all over the op-ed pages and the letter sections. They are.
They're well organized.
And we should be too. And doing the doable thing is fun once you start doing it.
Dan Savage, political activist, humanist of the year 2013.
Me and Gloria Steinem and P.Z. Myers and Richard Dawkins.
You and Margaret Sanger.
Margaret Sanger, Betty Friedan. I'm just flabbergasted. All of these people must be returning their awards posthumously.
And again, just to summarize, the reason that we gave Dan Savage this award is because we recognize that Dan is a highly ethical, highly moral person and is showing people how to be ethical and moral and politically active in the world. Plus, he's really cute.
Oh, shush.
This is Dr. Marty Klein. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Great interview. Thanks so much to Dan and also to Marty for connecting us to Dan.
Yeah, that was wonderful. And I'm certainly looking forward to next month where we'll be interviewing Marty and we will be getting some more sex talk and then on to other humanist topics. We promise we won't stay on sex forever, even though we like talking about it probably as much as you do. So anyway, listeners, feel free to leave a comment on our comment line 202-618-1371 and like us on Facebook. Also, you can get previous episodes, show notes, and again, the uncensored version of that interview, the longer version even, which can be found at thehumanisthour.org.
Check it out. It's going to be good.
Indeed. So, Kim, thanks so much. Welcome to your, your second show as co-host, and we'll get into the full routine next month. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Todd. Thank you. Everybody else, be human.
Have a good one. See you next month.
Bye.
Girl, it ain't no pain in me looking at you.
I don't give a